Blog Talk Radio.
Join Irma Francis as she explores the transformation from adulthood to soulhood. Having achieved the life goals of adulthood and met the expectations of family and society, we may feel like there is something missing. This something could be a direct contact with our soul. It is through soul contact that we become ready to let go of the conditioned self and allow our true self to step forward and take the lead. We shift into a deep and compassionate soulhood, connecting us to our divinity as well as our humanity. Irma Francis opens a portal to the exploration of soulhood by inviting open-ended inquiries into this eternal dimension.
Hello and welcome to Adulthood to Soulhood. This is Irma Francis and I'm joined by Ernie Vecchio, psychologist, author, and spiritual teacher. Hello, Ernie.
Hey, Irma. It's great to be here. I always feel like I enter the special dimension with you on that introduction every time we do it.
Well,
like a metaphysician.
Yeah. It's a wonderful energy to be in, that is for sure. We have a really good topic tonight. I'm excited about this. And actually, the paragraph that I'd like to read before we begin is taken from a podcast, a podcast you had on your website at one point. You had a part two, a part one and a part two. Do you recall?
I don't. That's okay. I've done so many of those. They kind of all run together.
Yeah. I'm sure. So as I read this, these are your words, and it's from your website and from a past podcast you had done with a client, I believe. So our topic tonight is the observer versus ego. From a spiritual perspective, the ego is that aspect of the self that considers its distinction from others through its identifications. In short, the ego is our sense of I and me that tends to approach life through our thinking. Spirituality, our true state of existence, is discovered through identification with the soul. From the soul's perspective, we can choose to live our day-to-day life with the consciousness of observation or true witness. Psychologically, we define ego as pride about oneself. Thoughts such as my intellect, my life, my wealth, my husband, and my children all need to be a specific way to acquire happiness. Where the soul reveals how life truly is, the ego tells us how life should or could be. So that is our topic tonight. And
now,
I
what
think
is, and it comes, You think what? You think what?
I don't know what I was just going to say.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say that came from, I won't should on you if you won't should on me.
Yeah.
When I was writing that, because that really is what the ego is all about, is all the shoulds and ought to be, ought to be and could be. And, this idea of observer has changed, and you know this just in the brief time that we've been working together. My expansion of the soul's role in all of this has just been magnified in the past year, because when I first wrote those words, I was talking about the soul's intent as it relates to the unconscious and it relates to the material that I was sifting through with all of my trauma patients. But now, as I begin to understand that this thing that we call the soul, which starts out as a burst of light as soon as the sperm contacts the egg, and we'll talk about this later on, I'm sure. But that burst of light has a pre-programmed kind of sense of what it is we need to do to get through this existence. And that pre-programming is pretty profound and very intelligent. And so it begins very early. You know, I used to think that the soul's intent was activated once we underwent adversity in the external world. But the truth of the matter is that we really begin communicating with the soul just as soon as we are created, very, very quickly, like within 5 to 6 weeks of our conception. The heart and the spinal cord and the brain are forming, and we're not conscious, but yet we have a physical sensation of a connection to the Creator and a sensation to the connection to the Source. And so I've gone deeper with that in my own sense of it now. And so if I thought it was intelligent before, that intelligence has been magnified in the past year of my sense of it. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So what you're describing, how you're describing that, so it's kind of like from the very beginning, from that burst of light and that meeting of the sperm and the egg, our soul is guiding us? Would you say it that
way?
Well,
I don't think it's guiding us at that point, but I think that the intelligence of the guidance system that is made up of the soul, the ego, the spirit, and the heart, I think the system is being formed. And its communication is symbiotic, and that it is working towards wholeness and towards completion. So, in other words, at that point, we're all one. We're all one. We're whole. We don't get disintegrated and really kind of separated from the Source until we enter this existence. And then, and really, even after we do that, Irma, we have almost 2 years in this existence before language that we're even still related to it. So it's still there. What lay people would call this is innocence, because we haven't been contaminated yet by what it means to be in the world. And so, so it's a three. It's almost 3 years of exposure, if you will, to an intelligence that so far exceeds our brain, and that we never forget it. I mean, it never goes out of our awareness. I mean, it's always there, and except for the ego getting in the way of it. That's the only thing that happens. But I don't think that the intelligence is guiding us at that point when we're still in the womb, but I think that the intelligence is forming, because the system, the guidance system, the formation of those organs of perception, which would be the heart and the ego and all that, is taking shape at that point. The ego, of course, is not, because we haven't come out. So really it's just at that point it's the heart and the soul. Really, the human spirit doesn't really come into existence until we're born, and the ego doesn't come into existence. So two pieces of that guidance system is being formed, and two of the most important pieces, I might add, because one is kind of like the satellite that the GPS is connecting to, which is the soul, and then the heart is the organ of perception that is directly connected to that satellite. So it's that kind of a picture or image, if you can see that in your head.
Yeah. And I was just sitting here when I first asked you the question I asked you. I was sitting here and being in that observer place, I observed my question of, so are you saying from the minute that light bursts and the sperm and the egg meet that the soul is guiding us? Just that question, it would imply that there's a separation, but at that point there really is no separation. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Oh yeah, exactly. There's a little bit of an echo. I don't know if the echo is on my end or your end. There's a little bit of an echo on Blog Talk.
It could be on my end.
There's no separation at that point. Yeah, at that point, you know, we've got nine full months. I mean, really, I guess closer to 8 months, 3 weeks, or whatever, because the brain, the spinal cord, and the heart is formed in that first 5 to 6 weeks, like after conception. So those organs of perception are are there and they're kind of connected to, synchronized, if you will, to the heart of the Creator, in this case, the Mother. So the ego and human spirit follows after birth. They're not really formed until we arrive.
And you're saying it's around two years old that we start to kind of leave that innocence and kind of take on a feeling of separation?
Yeah. Well, as soon as we take on language, which is, most of the experts say 18 to 24 months, as soon as we start to speak and take on language and begin to construct sentences and begin to identify with I and me, and begin to identify that we are separate from the Mother, separate from everybody, really. As soon as we begin to feel the separation of I and me as being different from everybody else and different from the Mother, that's when the ego forms. And so, it's not in our aware. I think children, and you've said this, that you had this as a child. I know I had it. I think all children have it. We have a connection to it because we're coming out of the chute really just really curious about everything. And that curiosity and all those questions that we ask, why is the sky blue? Why, where does the moon go when the faces change? And, where does the sun go when it's on a cloudy day? I mean, these are the kind of questions that young children ask. And and I think that curiosity kind of gets snuffed out as we start adapting. And dependent upon, how much adaptation we have to make is how quickly that happens. So some people that are kind of insulated and protected from life and don't really have a lot of adversity in the beginning, they may keep that curiosity longer and don't kick into a survival mode quite as early. But for those people who have a rough beginning, then they're kicking into a survival mode very quickly, and they're adapting very quickly. So their sense of that intelligence and their sense of that curiosity of asking why and wanting to know kind of gets put on hold or gets snuffed out. It really kind of turns to fear. I mean, that's what curiosity turns into. We stop asking questions, and we just start trying to go along with the masses to fit in,
And a lot of our conditioning, and I'm not being critical or judgmental as I'm saying this. I think I'm being more of an observer of life and the human condition, that we are kind of conditioned in the school system and in religion. If you're going to a church and there is one person that, the congregation is listening to, and in the school system, it's a group of children that are listening to one person. So we're kind of conditioned to go into that place of not asking questions, being more of in a place of being conditioned with whatever the teacher is giving out or whatever the pastor of the church is giving out.
I think we tolerate that. And I think the word you're looking for is submission. I think we submit.
Yeah, that's it. That's the word. Yep.
Yeah. I think we submit early on because we don't know what else to do. And that submission changes, or at least should change, as we hit junior high age. High school is when the hormones kick in, emotions start becoming overwhelming, and so what we think and feel about life, we're more adamant about maybe not going with the flow and maybe being, going against the reigning authority, whatever it may be at the time. And that's really what adolescence is supposed to be, is because teenagers are trying to establish a power base. They're trying to establish some sense of competence and effectiveness and adequacy in the world. And so they're going to question, and they're going to, kind of go against some of what they're being told and some of what they're being taught. And that's quite developmentally, kind of appropriate. But again, dependent upon how much freedom you have to do that and how much confidence you have in that experience determines how mature you become or how, or if you repress or suppress your emotions or your thinking. You know, it's kind of like the kid in the back of the room that's afraid to raise his hand, you know. And there's a bunch of, kids out there like that that are afraid to ask questions or afraid to go against the grain. They know something's off. They can't put their finger on what it is. It's going on inside of them, but they're asking an outside source for the answer, you see. When you're asking an outside source for what's going on inside you, you're going to get a confusing answer.
Go ahead, Ernie.
There's a delay tonight. I hate that when that happens.
Yeah, I know.
I was just going to say that it's a process. It's a process of going inside oneself and contemplating and reflecting and then coming back out and kind of experimenting with the world and then going back in again. So it's an in and out kind of process. And so when we come out, that's when we're coming out with questions. That's when we're coming out with our confusion, whatever it may be. So, yeah. And it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight.
I was just going to say, I wonder how a child's life would change or children's life would change if there was more flexibility of speaking up, of being allowed to be more curious. I did not grow up in systems like that, and I'm not sure exactly how grade school is today, but I just wonder, you know, what is going on in those little minds, and if there was even just a short period in the school day to just allow whatever questions within a child's mind to come out and to be heard. I think that would be...
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does happen in middle school. They do try to encourage individualization and uniqueness in children. The only problem that I think has happened over the years is we've put so much emphasis on positive reinforcement that we reinforce everything. And some things are just developmental stages that we go through. They shouldn't all be, you know, reinforced as special, unique kinds of things, but yet we're really high on positive reinforcement, and we do so much reinforcement that we don't that children are not prepared when things don't go the way they want it to go. In other words, when something is not positive, they don't know what to do with it. And life is made up of both positive and negative. It can't all be, you know, just reinforcement all the time, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, and
I was getting ready to say that I think of myself when I was an athlete that I learned more from my losses than I ever did from my wins, and I think that's true in life, that you learn more from when things don't go the way you expect them to go than if everything goes as planned, you know.
Yeah. And I was going to say, from, you know, raising three sons, I think, honestly, I think children know when adults aren't coming from this kind of truthful place, because really if you're, everything is positive and everything is great and rewarded, I think there's something within a child that knows that that's just not true. And actually, I think it could kind of create a sense of insecurity in a child.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that marks the entrance to adolescence, and I'm thinking maybe just as you start high school, like maybe the ninth, tenth grade, you begin to start seeing a lot of hypocrisy and noticing hypocrisy in the world. And if there's one thing that teenagers are great at pointing out, is the incongruence in what they experience and what they're being told. And when there's something incongruent, they register that. And I know in many of the teenagers that I work with, many of them don't want to grow up. When you look at the average age kids are leaving home today, it's like 27. Which kind of says, you know, and of course our generation, people were leaving home at 16 and 18 years of age, and those were rites of passage for us. Those rites of passage are now kind of blurry. I don't think that they're as clear as they used to be. And so young people look around at the adults in their lives and they go, well, you guys are not doing such a good job at being an adult. I don't think I want to be an adult. What I'm seeing in you is that life is stressful, life is hard, life is depressing, life is fearful. And so I want to stay a child as long as I can. And that's what a lot of kids are doing. They're just kind of refusing to grow up because they know as soon as they cross that threshold of into adulthood that it's coming with all of these negative things. That's very, very true in our culture right now. When you look at young people in terms of what they expect and what they think about the future and what they think about the adults in their lives, because that's where they get their original conditioning from. So depending upon whether or not that was a good or bad experience, then that determines whether or not they're anxious about becoming an adult.
Yeah, it's almost like they're saying, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Yeah.
That's exactly what they're saying. Why bother?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on the topic of our show tonight, so how would you define the observer versus ego, and why is that important for us to understand?
Well, I think I've got a couple thoughts on that, but you know, the first thing that comes to mind when you ask me that question is that the observer, if you can imagine that the left side of the brain thinks in a straight line, and it literally is, and we live in a left brain culture, so it's linear in its perception of things. It's also two-dimensional in its perspective of things. That we spend a great deal of time in our earlier life in that left hemisphere, in a left hemisphere culture. We don't get a lot of practice at using the right side of the brain that much. And the observer, if it was going to reside somewhere, it resides predominantly in the right side because it sees the whole picture. It sees, it sees everything. And so the importance of that is huge because context is what is lacking. If you don't have context, then you're going to be confused. And so, so the first answer, the first part to the question is that to connect with the observer, to connect with the witness that is inside of you, that is there in a neutral position, that views your life without judgment, is actually coming from the dimension of love and truth and freedom. In other words, that's where it lives, that's where it resides, that's where it gets its energy. So it sees the whole of things in a different way. And being able to step back and see all of something is invaluable to be able to see because it's context.
Right.
And the ego's job is to take us away from that, of course. It's not doing it on purpose. It's just not able to see until it's kind of present with itself. It's not able to see the whole picture. So I don't know if that answers the question, but I think that that being able to realize that you are that we've gone into every orifice in the body, we've dissected the brain, we cannot find the observer, but yet there is one in there. There is somebody inside the box, so to speak, and so you can identify with that and live your life based upon that observer's perspective, or you can look at life through the lens of the ego, and the two differences are two-dimensional and three-dimensional. So the right side of the brain sees three-dimensional time and sees three-dimensional space. It sees context, but the ego only sees life like a flat screen.
But we need the ego to function. And I think I just heard you say that the ego can't see the whole picture until it becomes present. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's not going to, and it's not going to do that. I think when we're younger, we have sound bites of presence, but we're not going to be able to hang on to it or stay with it when we're younger because we just have too many distractions. It isn't until we've developed a little bit and matured a little bit that we begin to recognize that the presence is really the gift of being human. That's one of the wonderful gifts that we have as people, is the capacity mm-hmm. to be present with our lives and our circumstances. So I think mm-hmm. young people have a sense of it in sound bites, but they don't know how to hang on to it. And
which is understandable.
I don't even know that it's developmentally possible when you're a young person, because you're just so busy trying to follow the path that you've cut or the path that's been cut for you. And mm-hmm. so presence isn't as important when we're younger. There's other things that have our attention, like I said before, power, being adequate, being successful, being pretty, being smart, being liked by other people, fitting in. These are the things that we're focused on when we're younger. Until we get a little older that we stop worrying about some of that stuff. Yeah.
Right. And also, as a child, part of the distractions is learning how to function in the state of ego, because a big part of what you're doing with, say, a toddler, you're teaching them to identify objects. You're creating identification, external identification. So they have to go through that process to be able to function and to know what things are. But I think it's a matter of adults that have gotten stuck in that place. Because to me, when I think of observer, I think of being rather than doing.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of like a doing from a place of being, which I think is possible. I don't know if that makes any sense to you or any of our listeners, but
yes.
I love that place. I love the place of being, doing while I'm being, because there's such a, a richness and a fullness in that, and it doesn't feel... it feels expansive. It feels free. And I think it's totally
We had that conversation one night. I think it was off the air, though. I think it was just one of our kind of Ernie Irma conversations where the soul, I said that the soul is attempting to dream us awake. Well, that's what you're describing.
Yeah.
You know, the best kind of dream you can have is the one you're having while you're awake. And so, I think that's Henry Thoreau or whatever who said that, but Henry David Thoreau. But yeah, I think that young people don't think they have time to dream, or they have other mm-hmm. concerns besides their dreams, or they may not think that their dreams are possible. And so that's part of what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time to get some confidence in that.
Yeah.
And I think the way Carl Jung broke this down is that we all start out in life kind of introverted or kind of extroverted. We have a little bit of both, but mm-hmm. lean toward one way or the other. So for a child who's introverted, then you want to do everything in your power to get them to come out, because they're having difficulty with self-expression. They're inside themselves probably more than they should be. And for an extrovert, you want to teach them how to go inside, how to reflect, how to contemplate, because they're so outside in the world that they're too externally controlled. So we all have a little bit of that introverted, extroverted stuff going on as we're developing. And so but what we may not have is the compensation there to offset it. And that's what mm-hmm. the environment and teachers and instructors and parents should be able to do, is to try to strike a balance. If you have an introverted child, then you want to try to cultivate their extroversion. And if they're extroverted, you want to cultivate their introversion. So both ways you're giving station to an internal life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key
mm-hmm.
here.
Yeah.
You know, to have an internal life as early as possible is the key here. Because if you have that internal life early, you won't lose it later on. If you don't have that internal life, then you will lose it for a while and may or may not get it back, you see.
Right. Yeah. Which, you know, can definitely be seen in adults. And now who is that? Is that Eli or Gracie?
I'm going to have to open the door. I hope you cut that out of our recording. When you, must be a deer on the property. I have no idea. That was both of them. One barks and the other one barks and then runs out the door.
So as I'm looking at this paragraph that I read and looking at the title of the show, The Observer versus Ego, and, you know, how you're kind of describing both, I just really, and I know we've talked about this on other shows, but I think it's really important to kind of every once in a while just go over again that the ego isn't necessarily a bad thing, something we want to get rid of. And I know you're so good at kind of putting the ego in an alignment with the soul, the heart, the spirit. Could you kind of go over that again for the listeners? I just think it's a major big deal, especially for the spiritual community, to see more of a complete picture of what the ego actually is.
Yeah, the ego, well, the soul in the context of the show we're talking tonight, the soul is the orchestrator of your life. In other words, it tends to wants you to see what it is that you need to see so you can get here. And so it's going to orchestrate your internal and external life to do that. The ego is kind of like a hard drive on the computer. It literally is just downloading and storing all the experiences, positive and negative experiences, but the ego tends to focus on the negative experiences, and so because that's where all the adaptation is, you know, you don't have to do a lot of adapting to positive stuff, but you have to adapt to adversity. So the human ego is an adaptive kind of organ of perception, and it's very, very good at navigating the outside world. Without the ego, we would not go to work, we would not brush our teeth, we would not take a shower, we would not do any of the functional things that that cause us to fit in the world and be in the world. So the ego adapts. It's the compensations that the ego throws in that may be dated or may be out of sync with reality, because since the ego is storing a lot of thoughts and ideas and perceptions with feelings, which then evolve to emotions, and they go kind of unchecked and they're not really looked at or examined, then they are lived as if they are the truth. And so the ego has no clue what the truth is. As it's developing, what it figures out is what fits in the outside world and what fits to survive in the jungle, so to speak. But it doesn't know anything else but that, and so that distinction is really important to get, that the human ego is adapting, and it is responding to the prodding of the human spirit, which is your feeling reaction to the present moment. And so that relationship of provocation, the motivator, so the ego wouldn't do anything without that motivation. So the human spirit, if it's been harmed, and it has in the beginning because it's cut away from the creator, but if it's harmed even worse once it arrives, once it comes into this existence and it's told that it isn't very smart or that it doesn't fit in or that there's something wrong with it, and we typically use guilt and shame to parent the ego. If the ego internalizes that as truth, then you have to at some point go back and undo that programming. So you can see that the adapting is the good and bad and ugly of this experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the ego tends to focus on the ugly. And because that's what it internalizes as its own deformity, if you will. If you're using guilt if you're using guilt and shame, if the culture is using guilt and shame, and I should also throw in fear to kind of cement. So fear is kind of the emotion that cements guilt and shame. And of course, guilt is that I can't make a right decision. I do everything wrong. That I just keep making mistakes after mistakes. Well, that turns into self-blame and self-punishment. And fear drives that. Shame is a little bit different because shame is I'm not worthy. I'm not love worthy. And so it's more of a self-worth issue, and fear also drives that as well. I was just going to say fear is the precursor emotion or feeling that then pairs with a thought, which is tied to guilt or shame, that then becomes the emotion of guilt and shame. And once those pairings have happened, they become internalized, stored away as if they are true. Mm-hmm. And we may go a lifetime, trying to undo that, but we all get exposed to it at some point. There's no way to escape it.
Yeah, and that would be coming from the adaptive ego. So here's a question. Does the ego have intelligence?
It has intelligence of the law of the jungle intelligence. It's accumulating life smarts. It's accumulating street smarts as it is evolving. It doesn't have a lot of emotional intelligence.
We need it as a tool to function and navigate our way through the jungle. it's helpful with that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's developing street smart and it's developing life smarts if it's evolving and growing at all. Not everybody gets street smarts and life smarts, even with adversity. But if it's evolving as it's supposed to be, then it's growing with these experiences. And the ego tends to operate on the hindsight's 2020 rule because mm-hmm. it doesn't have a lot of insight and it doesn't have any foresight. So you can see that would be a two-dimensional perspective. How do I survive this existence out here, this flat plane world that I'm in? How do I survive? How do I adapt? How do I get along? How do I fit in? These are the things that the ego is focused on. It doesn't evolve, the ego, until it gets present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the function of the human spirit. I mean, the soul wants presence, of course, because the soul is always in that observer position of presence. The ego has no idea what presence is at this point until we kind of grow into it. And that's why I say we have sound bites of it.
Could we even be in a place of observer unless we were present? Would that even be possible?
No. Presence and observing are kind of the same animal. Presence would be the condition that would allow observation to happen. So yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the two are kind of married to one another. Yes.
Yeah, and so, isn't observation so ego, connected to soul? Soul intelligence.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, because it is the soul it's really the soul that's doing the observing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the soul that really kind of senses. If you consider that, and again, we have a lot of different ways to define soul, and I think it gets kind of confusing. But I try to keep these things simple and say that the soul is what animates your body. That without the, in other words, it's your life force, and we know that life force has a. You can take a physical picture of it, and if you have the right instrument, you can take a picture of your body. And you have an energy field that's around you that's shaped like an apple. That is your life force. It is self-sustaining. Mm-hmm. It's never off, never gone, never away. Well, that life force has intelligence. And and so in that regard, it is constantly kind of orchestrating our lives inside and out, really, for us to see what it is we need to see for it to arrive. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. you think you're already here simply because you've been born. And like I've said many times on many shows I've done, is that you don't really get here until you choose to get here. And you do have a choice in that arrival. It doesn't just happen as birth. In fact, you know, Christians and religious people call it born again. Well, the reality is that the ego probably dies and is born again at least four times in a lifetime. So death and rebirth should be happening at least four times. It may mm-hmm. happen more than four, but a minimum of four times. And why four times? Well, the first time is adolescence, second time is young adult, third time is midlife, fourth time is old age. So those mm-hmm. those are developmental stages of death and rebirth, so to speak. So mm-hmm. so you want to be more. So my point on that is, you want to be more than just born again. You want to be born again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
And look what that does to the born again concept that religious people use. I mean, born uh-huh. again sounds like it's a one-time deal, and then once you're born again, and you have this incredible epiphany and awakening, that's it. You're done. You've arrived. But in actuality, you're stuck again as soon as you think you're finished arriving, because it's developmental. I mean, you're not going to fully get here until you work through all of the adaptation that no longer fits the present day moment. All those adaptations and all those strategies, defense mechanisms, personality traits, all those things that you might have taken on to survive your life may not fit the present. And that's what you have to look at.
And what if somebody got stuck there? What if somebody got stuck there? Well,
That's what personality disorder is. Personality disorder uh-huh. is a pervasive. It's a pervasive pattern of thought and emotion that cannot see beyond those patterns and beyond those emotions. And so that's what personality mm-hmm. disorder is in a clinical sense. That's what it is. Yeah. They're kind mm-hmm. of stuck. Mm-hmm. Their emotional growth has been stunted, which means their spiritual growth has been stunted, and their psychological growth has been stunted. So all of those, the emotional, the spiritual, the psychological, has all kind of been stunted. It's frozen in time.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that unfreezes anything is heat, and heat is suffering. And that's what the human spirit provides. The human spirit provides the heat. It provides the angst.
Or you've used the word, I think, friction. Would you say friction? Same thing?
Yeah. And now I'm saying even more that it's a self-corrective activity. In other words, the human spirit's angst is a self-corrective measure. It is happening to self-correct. It's the original self-correction, the very, very first one, was, wait a minute, I just got cut away from the source.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first self-correction. Well, that is the little tiny snowball that then grows into a larger snowball the more life you live and the more you accumulate suffering. So the original source wound, which is getting cut away from self, is what all other wounds kind of stick to.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can see how the layers get made. You know, I've said before that the ego is like an onion of layers and layers and layers of traits and beliefs and emotions and thoughts that really just don't fit the present moment. So you can see that those layers get formed very early. And nothing cuts through those layers better than trauma. Trauma, and I'm talking tragedy kind of trauma, really cuts through those layers very quickly. And that's what I learned in working with my clients is that if I cut your legs off, trust me, all the things you thought were important before, all the things that you worried about before, you know, just give me back my legs. The rest of that stuff mm-hmm. I took for granted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happens with severe trauma. It cuts through those layers very quickly. So my argument has always been that we shouldn't have to wait for a tree to fall on us for us to wake up, that we could voluntarily walk through our fears one at a time, and this is kind of an existential philosophy, walk through our fears as we move out of that prison that we originally constructed as a cage of self-protection. We move those bars out of the way, and we walk across this moat of fear, build a bridge to the truth, and the truth, mm-hmm. of course. And that's but it's a process, as you can see. It's a process that we all kind of have to make a choice to do. And so yeah, if you could just sit down anytime you're having any kind of issue in life, I don't care what it is, just stop and ask yourself what you're afraid of. Because that's the precursor emotion for all other emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could just put your finger on what you're afraid of and stop being afraid of it, everything changes.
Yeah. And one way to do that is to, I don't know exactly the process of how someone would make soul contact, but the soul has no fear. The soul mm-hmm. has no fear. So
correct.
So.
Well, remember what you're trying to do is train the ego to trust its own reality. And this is what psychosis would be. A psychotic person doesn't have the capacity or has lost faith in their capacity to do good reality testing and actually test. You know, do a reality test and then actually trust what they experience and trust what they see. And so reality testing is really, or lack of it, is really what causes psychosis. People that have psychotic problems are stuck in their own reality versus reality itself.
Hmm.
And so it's... So doing reality testing is key. What am I afraid of is a very important question. And remember, we said in previous shows, a natural state of the human ego is anxiety. And really, the natural state of anxiousness is, am I enough? Am I okay? Am I secure? Am I doing this right? Am I correct? Am I going the right direction? This is the natural state of the ego.
Mm-hmm. But something you just said about reality, you said it in a way that kind of insinuated that there's one reality.
Well, no, there's...
I know that sounds like a weird question, but I have a reason for asking it.
No, if you look at science, they're saying there's multiple dimensions, but that's not the kind of reality I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that truth in this conversation isn't information, it's a place.
Right.
So the one reality that you're looking for is integrity. Like if I stand on the floor,
Yeah.
Then I know that the floor has integrity. In other words, what it's doing what it's supposed to do. And so what you're seeking in your reality testing is, does my sensation of what is true, does it stand up? Does it hold up to truth? And you can only figure that out if you test it. Like I said to you once before, if you're a little boy and you think there's a boogeyman in the closet, and I walk you over to the closet and I turn on the light to show you that there's nobody there, what you should do is go to bed and say, okay, turn the light off, I'm fine. But if you're a little boy and you haven't got that confidence yet, you're going to say, okay, I believe you, but leave the light on anyway. So in other words, mm-hmm. the reality test didn't work. And so that's it. So it's got to stand the test of validity, of integrity. And that's what this is what the soul was really pushing us to do, is to have self, you know, to stop doing self-deception. Because if we're deceiving ourselves, then we don't have a sense of our own integrity. That really is the concept of the inner child. I mean, the inner child formed because it is kind of the repressed aspect of ourselves that is put away and compartmentalized. If you have the authentic child, and then you have the not okay child. Well, that not okay child is where the work is. And the spontaneous, authentic child is what wants to be free and wants to get here. Well, it's not going to trust if it didn't have a lot of experience with trust with people in its life or with things in its life. So we learn to not trust by getting violated again and again and again. And if we make up that it's us, that we're the problem, then we're not realizing that the people that or the circumstances that failed us are the problem, not us, you see. But we tend to think that it's us.
Yeah. And so
when I say it's got to stand up, you have to be able to do a reality test and check yourself. And then in that moment, and as you can imagine, that requires a moment of presence, a moment of reflection, a moment of stepping back and observing the whole of something to see where do I stop and start and where does the situation stop and start and how much of it's me and how much of it's them. This is the kind of stuff you have to do. And then you learn, of course, in doing that, that you have no control over them. You only have control over them. You only have control over yourself. Yeah, you only have control over yourself. And so, I mean, I look at my own demons, for example. I told you that shame is my demon, and I spent a lifetime trying to heal that in myself. But I used to think it was shame on me or shame on you. It was always shame on me. I was the one that messed up. I was the one that did something wrong. Until I finally stopped doing that, you know. I was told my whole life that, for example, that I had trouble with authority, which was true. I did. But I also figured out that authority had trouble with me as well.
Yeah. I probably shouldn't be laughing, but
no. But I'm saying it's that kind of inner dialogue. So somewhere between those two extremes, you see, Irma, lies the truth.
Yeah.
Somewhere between them, between us and them, lies the truth. And so, being able to see the truth. You've got to be in that observer position to do it. And as you can imagine, it takes a certain amount of maturity, a certain amount of time on the planet. You know, I typically say around midlife is when we're probably more adept at doing that than any other time, because we've already spent so much time doing everything the ego said we needed to do and what the collective ego said we needed to do, and that something's missing. And then we discover, oh, my gosh, it's me. I'm missing. I'm so busy adapting and fitting in and acquiring and obtaining and succeeding that I lost myself along the way. And and so it's around midlife that we begin to get a sense of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, I guess that's kind of the process and the development of human beings at this point in time in 2016. Do you think we'll ever evolve to developing differently?
I think if people, you know, I'm going to say this. This is a bold thing to say, but I'm going to say this. I think that if people that are hearing these shows and understand what it is that I'm saying, that if you can grasp the idea that your suffering is a self-corrective measure, that your adversity was handed to you to self-correct, not correct it, but correct how you handle it, how you internalize it. That's the self-correction. That you can change your life in incredible ways. So I think that is the evolution. And of course the first aid cream, the salve, the healing ointment for this is self-love. So self-love in the context of the work I do is suffering with oneself. That is compassion. You suffer with oneself instead of for oneself, because if you suffer for, then you're a victim.
Right, right. Yeah, and if you didn't have the self-love, when you do come up against adversity or suffering, probably one and the same, if you didn't have self-love, then you would become a victim and you would become powerless and probably just stop evolving, because you would be, very, very interesting. So I I'm not sure exactly what words I would use, but I guess I would use the word faith, that life itself is self-correcting. Through human beings, life itself is self-correcting. There is evolving
going
on.
You can just see what's happening in the culture. If you don't think that the collapsing of institutions and corporations and governments is not a self-correcting mechanism, that's exactly what it is. So mm-hmm. Happening in a macrocosm kind of way, we are shifting to a place in the culture of integrity. And for us to get there as human beings, a bunch of things have to collapse before we're going to get there. So that really is the reset button. So we do have to reset. So if it's happening in a collective sense that a bunch of things need to be reset for us to start again, then it also makes perfect sense that it's happening inside of us as well, that we have to reset.
Yeah.
We have to reset to start again. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that makes total sense to me. So, you know, when we see things collapsing and these systems of what we thought were security collapsing around us, it may seem like, you know, the world is full of chaos and crisis, but it could be, not could be, I believe it is, leading us towards a different way of being human.
Well, it's a pendulum. It's a pendulum of chaos to order. we've gone through a pretty ordered structure in 250 years of order in our country, and now we're moving into a chaotic time, and we have been for a while. And so the order will come back. Order will come back, but not until chaos is finished. You see, the reset has to happen. But you don't have to be afraid of it if you have internal controls and you have internal connection to your own world, your own universe, then you're going to be fine no matter what happens. If the ego adapted before, it'll adapt again, you see. If you're present with that adaptive function, then it's going to be easier because you're not going to have the same fears and worries. So you can see the benefit of maturity. If you've got a mature present tense ego, you can adapt to anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. Yeah.
Yeah. I like your analogy of, I don't know exactly how you put it, but having the rope tied to the tree kind of, and that tree is your center and your groundedness. I talked about that recently with you, and I think I was feeling, I don't know, anxiety or maybe not centered or something. And I said something and you brought up that analogy. And I had realized that I had untied the rope from that tree. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
and
I always keep that analogy with me.
Yeah.
Or at least the ego told you you untied it. because it's never really. See, that's just it. So as long as you're grounded, if you've ever been grounded, and ever been connected to the source, you're not going to cut that. You're going to get distracted from it, but you're not ever going to cut it. You see, that would be totally away from it. But
the ego had to hold there.
yeah. It's almost like jumping out of an airplane with no parachute. You know, the ego would tell you that you forgot to pack your chute. And, when you know full well that you did, it's like, I know I packed it, and I know I did it correctly, you know. But the ego is going to say, "Are you sure? Are you sure you packed it?" And all it takes is just a little bit of doubt, and then you're going to be like screaming all the way down, you know?
Yeah, really.
And somebody's just pull the cord, Irma. Everything's going to be fine. The chute's going to work. It's going to be fine.
Oh my gosh! What a great show! Thank you so much, Ernie. This has been insightful as usual. So thank you for sharing your wisdom with me and with our listeners. And I look forward to next week's topic. And good night, listeners. Have a wonderful week. And good night, Ernie.
Good night, Irma. Talk to you later.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.